It feels beautiful to feel this settling. I can see that quite a few people have really experimented with postures, and that's working out. It seems that everybody's finding a pretty comfortable place, way to sit, or one or two different ways. And I can really feel the energy of that. How that really helps to go deeper, to be able to sit well and comfortable. For this sharing now, it's okay to not sit in a meditation posture. If you want to kind of lounge around, it's also okay. It's just good to, if you can stay awake and alert for that. So it really feels like, it really feels like there's a settling today in the air inside us. It feels like there's a sitting into that armchair. That's nice. Because then it spreads to the whole, all of us, to the group. And that's wonderful. I love that yesterday your sharing, Sumedha, on the effects of our like hidden anxieties of around our impermanence. The way you said it was really amazing. It really clicked in. It was like, all right, you're just going in the deep end there, aren't you? this underlying anxiety that we have around our immortality, not being worked out yet by the top scientists. And the second effect, the ripples that has, you know, on our lives. These undercurrents of anxiety that we put other reasons on, but if we really look into it, it can often be around that, wanting things to be fixed, wanting things to stay as we want them. I want to share a story, and it's also from the poems that Sumedha was talking about yesterday, the Terigata, by the first nuns from the Buddhist order 2,600 years ago. And as you were saying, they're the oldest spiritual writings by women that there are in the whole world, whole galaxy probably. And I really love them. And I keep looking for different translations because some of the translations are really like dry, you know. It's like they've taken the essence out of them and they've just taken the boring ones, where the nuns are talking about how good it is to not have to do the washing up anymore, you know, or to not have to marry somebody who's much older than, they were arranged marriages even then, you know. So they became nuns and then, whew, you know, they got out of that one. So there's a lot of poems like that. But I'm convinced that those nuns who were enlightened all those years ago, it wasn't just about the washing up, not doing the washing up, you know. Even if that's a continuing issue for all of us, the washing up in all cultures. But I did it 3 weeks ago. And how to work that out. And in those days, people used to write a poem about their enlightenment, or the Buddha would give someone a poem about how they would get enlightened. And they'd all be sitting there in silence, just like us. And then suddenly, someone would jump up and say their little poem, you know. And I just wish that I'd been around in those days. Because I think that would have been a good time, you know, when people just popping up like popcorn, you know, saying their little enlightenment poems. And I wonder, I really wonder if maybe enlightenment was easier to get to in those days, or is it just how we see it, you know? Do we see it as some impossible state up there that we'll never get to? and that actually, in truth, we have moments, we have flashes of enlightenment, but we're not in the habit of jumping up and saying a little poem about it, are we? So, just to say that that's an option on this retreat. You're really welcome, you know, if you... not to come in late and disturb the meditation, but if you feel a glimpse of enlightenment, to jump up and say your little poem, be fine. So this poem I forgot my glasses in France, which wasn't good, wasn't clever. Is the story of Subha, Jiva Kamba Vanika. And she was a bhikkhuni, so she was a nun. And it's actually quite complicated, this language, and it's taken me about 5 reads to really understand it. It's old-fashioned. So I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to paraphrase it, because I think that's going to be easier. Because it's a little bit kind of medieval language, and it's not Finnish. But I'll start, and then I'll... A rogue. You know what a rogue is? Like a baddie, you know? A bandit. Stopped the bhikkhuni Subha as she was going to the delightful Shiva Kamba wood. Subha said this to him. What wrong has been done to you by me that you stand obstructing me? For it is not fitting, sir, that a man should touch a woman who has gone forth. A woman who has gone forth, that means a woman who's become a nun. Whose training was taught by the welfarer, that means the Buddha. In my teacher's severe teaching, why do you stand obstructing me who am possessing the purified state without blemish? Why do you, with disturbed mind and with passion, stand obstructing me who am undisturbed with passion, departed without blemish, with mind completely released in every respect? So she knows it. She's saying, you know, I'm pretty enlightened, you know. How dare you try to stop me? And he goes, you are young and not ugly. What will being a nun going forth do for you? Throw away your yellow robe. Come, let us delight in the flowery wood. The towering trees send forth a sweet smell in all directions with the pollen of flowers. The beginning of spring is a happy season. Come, let us delight in the flowery wood. At the same time, the trees with blossoming crests cry out, as it were, what delight will there be for you if you plunge alone into the wood? You wish to go without companion to the lonely, frightening, great wood, frequented by herds of beasts, disturbed by cow elephants, who are excited by bull elephants. Now he's really adding it. You will go about like a doll made of gold. Oh, incomparable one, you will shine with beautiful... No, I've missed a bit. You will shine with beautiful garments of fine muslin, with excellent clothes. He's saying, if you come with me, I'll give you some lovely clothes. Of gold, you know, you will shine. He's trying to buy her with clothes now, you know. I should be under your command. So he's saying, I'll even let you boss me around. That's quite something. If we dwell inside the grove, if we live in the forest, for there is no creature dearer to me than you. Oh, Kinari with pleasant eyes. If you will do as I say, being made happy, come. We can live in a house. We can live in a palace. There will be women to attend on you. You'll even have servants. So the washing up. forget it, you know, good deal. You can wear nice clothes, put on flowers and nice perfumes. I shall make much varied adornment, jewels. You know, he's really going for it, huh? He's really laying it on thick, all this. You'll even have a bed with a duvet. Well washed of dirt. Beautiful. Very costly. So you, O liver of the holy life, will go to old age with your limbs your own. I'm not sure what that means. If he's proposing not to touch her, I don't know. It's a bit weird. Your eyes are indeed like those of Turi, like those of a Kinari, I think that's a bird, inside a mountain. Having seen your eyes, my delight in sensual pleasures increases more. Having seen your eyes in your face, to be compared with the bud of a blue lotus, you know. For there are no eyes dearer to me than you, O Kinari with pleasant eyes. And she says, you wish to go by the wrong path. You seek the moon as a plaything. You wish to jump over Mount Meru, you who pursue a child of the Buddha. It's like wrong story, you know. But she then explains in quite a strange language about how the root of craving has been smitten in her, taken away, burned out. So she no longer has this going on. For my mindfulness is established in the midst of both reviling and praise, happiness and pain. Knowing that conditioned things are disgusting, my mind does not cling to anything at all. So she's saying she's not moved by the different movements of pleasant and unpleasant, happiness. She's not clinging. I'm a disciple of the welfarer of the Buddha. With my dart drawn out, that means she no longer suffers, I rejoice. For well-painted puppets have been seen by me, fastened by strings and sticks, made to dance in various ways. And for me, this is really a crucial point. This is she's saying, I can't be anybody's puppet. I won't be manipulated by anything. These strings and sticks have been removed, thrown away, scattered, not to be found, broken into pieces. On what there would one fix the mind? O blind one, you run after an empty thing, like an illusion placed in front of you. Like a golden tree at the end of a dream, like a puppet show in the midst of the people. An eye is like a ball set in a hollow, having a bubble in the middle with tears. Removing it, she takes out her eye. The good-looking lady, because she's good-looking, that's why he stopped her, you know, having an unattached mind, was not attached to it, her eye. Or her mind, I suppose. Come, take this eye for yourself. Straight away she gave it to the man. And straight away his passion ceased there. That was end of love story, hey? And he begged her pardon. Become whole again, liver of the good life. Such a thing will not happen again. Become whole again, forgive me. And then that bhikkhuni released went to the presence of the excellent Buddha. Having seen the one possessing the marks of excellent merit, her eye was as before. So her eye magically healed when the Buddha saw how enlightened she was. So it's a myth, hey? To be taken with a big old pinch of salt. I'm not sure, do you have an expression for that in Finnish? To take something with a pinch of salt? Daniel, maybe?
Just say, taking lightly.
Yeah. Yeah, to be taken very lightly, these kind of stories. But when I first read it, or the first two times or something, because it has a very strange language, that's why I kept on cutting in and out of reading, you know. I was a bit like, oh, okay, you know, this Buddhist thing, just no desire, end of story, no sex life, or, you know. A bit severe, you know. And then I read it a few more times and I started to get a deeper understanding of this. Because it feels to me like actually she's this bhikkhuni, Subha, is really standing in her own integrity. She's standing in a kind of wholehearted strength. She's living her strength. And no flattery or praise or promise can shake her in that. And I imagine that she's not like some really tough one just saying, hey dude, I'm not interested, you know. That she's just like, no, it's okay. You know, I don't need nice sheets and I don't need jewels and I don't need all that because I like meditation. You know? And this equanimity that comes from that meditation is what I'm into, and you can't sway me. There's nothing you can promise, even to not do the washing up, that will change that, you know. It's like I'm into this. So for me, I take it now, this story, less as oh we all need to be monastics, you know, but more that this life path of meditation can really bring us into this wholeness, this integrity to be real to ourselves, to sit in our place. It doesn't matter whether you're a nun or not a nun, or something else. As we know, there's many things to be. But to really sit in that place that's your own with integrity, that nobody could push you around by flattering your ego, you know? Or as they say in more Buddhist terms, by playing with your sense of self, by inflating you or deflating you, because there's often as much sense of self in feeling not good enough as in feeling, you know, big and arrogant. It's kind of two sides of the same coin in a way. So I found that she had a lot to say, Subha, about belonging in the universe. She wasn't doubting that what she was doing and what she'd chosen was okay. How is that? Does anyone want to share something to do with this story? Or add something? Yeah.
Just since there was no target.
There was no what?
No target. For flattery or for anything.
That she couldn't be a target.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I started getting some glimpse of that the hard way. Well, maybe I shouldn't start telling stories, but as you know, I was a street musician, and you could play, and somebody would say, that was the most incredible thing I ever heard. And then another time, somebody might say, why don't you get a real job? Or, you know, you're going to be pushed up and put down.
Yeah.
And after a while, I learned, well, just let it come. You know? I mean, just keep playing, sort of.
It's funny because I met a musician not that long ago, and he was saying, he said the funny thing about being a musician is that you, or a creative person in that way, is that you open to creativity and you offer that to people. And so you're offering your open heart. And then you're a bit kind of vulnerable, you know? And then sometimes your friend said, oh, you didn't play very well tonight, or something, you know? And it's like, crash! Just after you've been appreciated by some people. And this musician, who was actually a famous musician, he suddenly turned around. I thought he was just some session guy. And then he went, oh, actually, I've played with so-and-so and so-and-so. And then he started telling me how difficult it is for the ego to work with this opening, and then the kind of criticism you get, and the inflation and all that. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, hang on, I just need to check time. I'm not very good with times, you know. Yeah, no, I've not finished. I was just warming up here. Yeah.
Sumi, from that story, it caught my ear the way that, to me, the language is actually quite beautiful.
Mm.
And it's quite passionate language, even from both sides.
Mm.
Really passionate. Also, the bhikkhuni. And it strikes me in her words, the passion that she has for the practice.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes, like earlier in my practice, I thought it's all about getting rid of passion. It's all about getting rid of wanting and desire and all that stuff. But... from that example, or thinking about the life of the Buddha, it would not be possible without some kind of passion for the practice, passion or desire for equanimity, the love of the practice, love of freedom. And that's what speaks to me about the Kuni case.
Yeah, totally, yeah. And sometimes I think we get a bit confused, you know, with the more... the way Christianity has picked it up of selflessness, you know, and where we kind of disappear as a person and sacrifice ourselves and get out the way. I think sometimes that happens in Western society with Buddhism, you know. We get a bit confused there, and people think that non-self and not believing in a solid sense of me, a conditioned me all the time, means not existing in a way, and getting ourselves out the way, and it's not like that. So there can be, if you're a passionate person, there can be passion, you know. And some people, I think their way is more pastel coloured, you know, more watercolours. There's as many ways as there are people and of coming into it. And for sure, we need some desire, some intentions, some effort, without getting into like full-on striving, you know, without bringing that madness of our modern society of needing to achieve into meditation. You know what I mean? That, I think of it as someone driving a car, you know, with the knuckles white, you know, teeth clenched. If we're bringing that energy into meditation, it's going to get difficult, hey? So it's like relaxing, put the shoulders down, don't hold the wheel too tight, you know? Which brings me to what else I wanted to speak about, which is just some guidelines if I have... I think I have time, if I shorten it. But maybe I could finish this evening or something. So they're called like the four paths to successful meditation. And it sounds like one of those self-help books, you know, that you see at the airport or something. But it's kind of like four ways that can really help us in meditation and out of meditation. And one of them is, or the first one is patient persistence. So just especially in meditation, as we've been speaking about in the one-to-ones, we fall off, you know, we get distracted. And then to be patient and to start again. And then again and again. And years later, we're still doing that. We're still being patient with ourselves. And the same outside of meditation, with our own transformation process. If we try to hurry up, it's like trying to tell a tree to grow, you know. You can water the tree, you can put fertilizer, but the tree is going to grow as quick as it's going to grow. So we can't transform quicker than that, than our own natural rate of growth. It's not going to happen. Even with, you know, Monsanto fertilizer or whatever, you know. It's not going to happen. So to have that patience with ourselves, that is going to take time. It's going to take time, and we're going to need a lot of patience for that. And to just know that as a handy tool, we're going to need to keep asking ourselves for patience. And like you wouldn't, like a kid who's learning to walk, when they don't get it right, you don't tell them off, you know. You don't get angry with a kid who's learning to walk. It's kind of the same. You can have that same attitude to our meditation. It's like, why would you get angry with a kid learning to walk? They're just learning to walk. You just pick them up again. They fall over and they go from the table to the chair and they run across that bit, 1, 2, 3 steps. And you go, yeah! And to be like that, in the beginning of our practice, when we're just starting meditation, and in the middle, and the end, if there's an end, maybe it's not like that, but to always have that celebration of our insights and understandings, to really have a party, you know? Even tiny insights, tiny breakthroughs, tiny understandings, to have a party about that inside yourself. And so not to judge, not to, if you sit down to a meditation session, to never ever say that was a bad one, you know, because there's no bad one. Even just sitting and holding the posture is a meditation, you know. It's something to offer in celebration. So that's the one, patient persistence. Another one is curiosity. To have an inquiring mind about our meditation. So the same, so to not just sit on the otto root once we've found a comfortable technique and go down it, but to really, like a I can, you know, those insects that have the big antenna things, you know, that go like that, and they look like they can't see, and they're going around like that. You know, like one of them kind of thing. Something that keeps looking around. What's it like? What's it like? What does it taste like? You know, to really keep cultivating and developing curiosity and meditation, I find is enough for me for the rest of my life, actually. To be curious about, what's happening now? In every moment, what's happening now? What's the texture? What's new today? What new path could I explore inside, you know? So that's inquiry. Some people call it inquiry. So to meditate in, once you're settled, to meditate in an inquiry state that's not piercing, that's soft and kind. What's happening? What's happening now? And what I find interesting about curiosity is I can never be down when I'm curious. I can never be depressed and curious at the same time. It doesn't work. Because curious is like your eyebrows. It's like that. Hey. You just can't do curious and be down. So to bring up a spark of curiosity can be really, really helpful in yourself, to get to know your own curiosity so that you can go and get it when you need it. Go, hey, curiosity, come, let's go for a walk. The other one is like a loop back feed, so that in a way it's kind of like mindfulness. So you're like the cook who's making a soup, and you're putting different things in and you're tasting to see what's missing. Does it need more salt? Does it need, you know? So you're doing meditation in an alive way of, hey, what's needed now? Or even in your outside of sitting meditation, you might be going, well, today's more of a standing meditation day. Or for this time, I need to not meditate. There are moments when I'm in a really bad state, I don't meditate, because then I would habituate myself for meditation to be to give it a strange color. So there's just some particular states, some days I go, no, not today. And there are moments when it's just not the moment, and there are moments when it's good to meditate some more. But to have this feedback thing where you're learning from mistakes, you're learning from what you're doing. Do you know what I mean by feedback loop? So it's not just going along forgetting what's happened. You look back a bit sometimes, go, oh, that was really good. That, I'll try that again. That worked, you know. That didn't work. Maybe I should try it again anyways, but maybe not. Or, you know, those were good conditions. Those were not. But again, in a gentle way, you know, not in a harsh, judgmental way. Because if we go like that, you know, right, in a military kind of way, if you get distracted one more time, we're really in trouble, hey, if we bring that into our meditation. It needs to be soft. And developing that soft light to shine on where we're at now, without checking out where other people might be at. That's not relevant to ourselves. And the last one of these four, so there's patient persistence, curiosity or inquiry, loop back feed, so giving yourself a little bit of feedback, which ties in with the patient persistence in a way. It's almost the same. It's a cousin maybe. And the last one is wholeheartedness. To go at it with wholeheartedness. So it reminds me sometimes some people say to me, because we run a meditation place, and some people say, oh, you do that. Oh, I tried meditating once. It didn't work. And it's a bit like, well, you know, if you tried the grand piano once and you weren't a superb pianist, it's like, of course not, you know. You need to practice a bit. So this going for it with some wholeheartedness can give strength, give some muscles to the practice and some energy, you know. I've got a story about wholeheartedness, but I think there's not really time now. So maybe I'll save it for later. Maybe someone can remind me about to tell the story of wholeheartedness, yeah? Are there any questions or anyone want to share something?
A question about these chants, if it's possible to ask now about them.
Yeah.
Is it a tradition that they are only chanted once?
Yeah.
Instead of, you mean like mantra repetition?
Yeah.
I mean, you suppose you could do that. There's other forms of like purita, blessing chants, which sometimes the tradition is to chant them like for the whole night, like to just kind of keep going because it's supposed to open a stream. Those particular chants are all from like the teachings, so it's more like you would chant it once and let the everything sink in. But yeah, there's different, yeah, horses for courses kind of thing.
It's true that sometimes it's really nice and you just want to do it again, no? Yeah. Which one are you looking at?
No, I didn't. Just both of them.
Yeah.
It feels like we just started. Are we going to stop now? Like,
No.
When we only sing it once.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we will. That in this retreat, we'll do it like that. But you could have a chanting retreat at home where you say, okay, I'm going to do that chant 15 times today, because that's what gets you in there, gets you into the flow.
There is also a mantra with those four qualities as well, which I've heard, you know, like that's really nice to chant over and over.
Mudita upeka, metta, karuna, mudita upeka. Oh, yeah. I'm going to just finish with a poem. It's quite small. For someone who's forgotten their glasses. It's also a little bit obscure from what I'm being saying, but it is connected, but maybe the connection will come in towards the end of the week. So I'll stay a bit mysterious about that. Wow. I really can't see. Would you lend me your glasses?
Try.
Are they really thick?
Yes, here, if you look here.
Yeah.
You can try if they are.
Yeah, because just in this light, I really can't see.
Do you want more
light? No.
Are they working?
Not at all. No, it's going to work. That's horrible. The most alive moment.
Yeah.
That was the title. The most living moment comes when those who love each other meet each other's eyes, and in what flows between them then. To see your face in a crowd of others, or alone on a frightening street, I weep for that. Our tears improved the earth. The time you scolded me, your gratitude, your laughing, always your qualities increase the soul. Seeing you is a wine that does not muddle or numb. We sit inside the cypress shadow, where amazement and clear thoughts twine their slow growth into us. So this is by the poet Rumi, the mystical Sufi poet, and they often speak of spiritual enlightenment as love, and one and the same thing, you know. So they often speak of the lover, the beloved, and they're actually talking about, you know, like what Christians would call union with God or whatever, enlightenment. So I offer these, this sharing to you, and I hope that it's helpful. And anything that's not helpful, just let it go into the lake. And thank you very much for your kind attention.